This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Good as Gone by Amy Gentry, performed by Karen Peaks. For Curtis, the best living human. Prologue. Jane woke up and whispered, "Julie?" The room yawned around her. After 2 years of sleeping alone in her own bedroom in the new house, Jane no longer dreamed of the ceiling fan dropping onto the bed and chopping her up. The spiders, too, had vanished from the shadows. 10-year-olds don't need to have the corners checked before bedtime. Only occasionally, when something woke her in the middle of the night, the silence around her ached for Julie's soft breathing. In the old house, she used to hoist one foot over the top bunk railing and giggle until Julie said, "Shh, Janie, go back to sleep." Now she shut her eyes tightly before they could drift toward the dark scenes where the walls and ceiling met. The next noise definitely came from Julie's room. Jane pulled back the covers and slid her bare feet down to the carpet. In the old house, a braided rug slipped over the smooth wooden floor when she got out of bed. Now her feet barely made a sound on thick carpet as she padded to the door and peered down the dark hallway. A faint rectangle of lighter darkness hovered at the end. A closed door. They rarely slept with doors closed. Janie's room got too hot, Julie's too cold. Mom grumbled about the air circulation in two-story houses, but Mom and Dad's room downstairs on the first floor was always shut at night because they were adults. Now Julie was too, or wanted to be. Ever since her 13th birthday, she seemed to be practicing for adulthood all the time, brushing her hair slowly in front of the bathroom mirror as if rehearsing for some secret play, sitting at her desk to write in her diary instead of flopping on the bed stomach first like Jane, and closing her bedroom door. At the end of the hall, the pale rectangle shuddered, a crack of darkness opening up around one side. Julie's bedroom door receded inward. Four large fingers hooked around its edge. Before she had time to think, Jane ducked into her closet, crouched down, and pulled the door shut behind her. The fingers. They were too high up on the door to belong to Julie, too large to belong to her mother. They didn't belong to her father, either, but she didn't know how she knew they didn't, and that was the most unsettling thing of all. A tiny, sickening click reminded her that the closet door never stayed closed for long. She threw her hands forward, but the door was already floating slowly open. Jane squeezed her eyes shut as a soft tread started down the hallway. When she opened them a moment later, the closet door had come to rest 3 inches from the doorframe. The slice of hallway visible from her hiding place almost glowed against the closet's deeper darkness. She could see every fiber in the beige carpet, every ripple in the wall paint, and, hanging on the wall, half of a framed studio portrait in which long-ago Jane sat on long-ago Julie's lap, wearing a baby dress with a sailboat on it. The sailboat shook on its embroidered waves. Everything else was shaking, too. The steps continued toward Jane's room. The noisy floorboard in the middle of the hall moaned. The owner of the hand was now halfway to her room. Could he hear the creak in her ears each time her thundering heart shook the little boat? Jane resisted the urge to shrink back into her clothes on their rattling hangers. Just then, a skinny foot appeared against the carpet, a patch of pink polish clinging to the big toenail, and Jane let out her breath. It was only Julie. She'd crouched over her toes, perfecting the pink for an hour before her birthday party, but by the middle of the summer, most of it had scraped off on the rough white bottom of the backyard pool, leaving only these little triangles around the edges. So Jane had been wrong about the fingers, seeing things again, like the spiders in the shadows. Sure enough, here came Julie, moving into the frame with her ordinary Mickey Mouse nightshirt flapping around her ordinary knees, heading toward the staircase by Jane's room, probably just going down for a midnight snack. Jane's matching Donald Duck nightshirt was in a brown bag waiting to be taken to Goodwill, She'd already outgrown it. Her mom said she'd be taller than Julie someday. Jane hugged her pajamaed knees in relief. But the fingers were back, this time perched on Julie's shoulder, clutching at the fabric of her nightshirt, her long blonde hair trapped between their knobby knuckles. Jane barely had time to notice Julie's stiff, straight posture, like that of a wide-eyed puppet, before she saw the tall man following close behind her. Julie and the strange man moved together in slow motion, as if his long arm and hairy hand were a chain binding them together. "Wake up, wake up, wake up," Jane told herself, but nothing happened. Everything was frozen, including her, like in a dream. Only Julie and the man kept moving. Slow, but faster than frozen. Slow, but they were almost to her room. Janie opened her mouth to scream. Then Julie saw her. Jane's scream slid back down into her stomach as Julie stared straight into her closet hiding place. Jane stared back, begging Julie to tell her what to do next, readying herself to obey, to yell or cry, or maybe even laugh if it was all a joke. Surely Julie wouldn't leave her alone in this bad dream. If Julie would just tell her what to do, Jane promised silently, she would listen to her and never complain from now on. Without moving her head, Julie lifted her eyebrows and glanced meaningfully toward the man behind her, then back to Jane, as if telling her to take a good look. But Jane didn't want to. She kept her eyes trained on Julie instead. Girl and man turned on the landing without pausing at her door, and Jane saw why Julie was walking so stiffly. The man held the tip of a long, sharp knife to her back. Jane felt a nasty sting like a bug bite between her own shoulder blades, and her eyes filled up with tears. They were poised at the top of the stairs when a loud tick sounded from the attic. Jane knew it was only the house settling, but the man stopped and looked over his shoulder nervously. In the split second before he looked back, Julie, as if freed from a spell, turned her head to Jane, raised her left index finger to her lips, and formed them into a silent O. "Shh." Jane obeyed. Julie started down the stairs, followed by the man with the knife. And that, according to the only witness, is the story of how I lost my daughter. Both my daughters. Everything. Everything. In a single night. 1. Julie's been gone for 8 years, but she's been dead much longer. Centuries. When I step outside into the steaming air on my way to teach my last class of the spring semester. The middle of May is as hot as human breath in Houston. Before I've even locked the door behind me, a damp friction starts up between my skin and clothes. 5 more paces to the garage and every hidden place slickens. By the time I get to the car, the crooks of my knuckles are sweating up the plastic sides of the insulated travel cup, and my grip slips as I climb into the SUV, throwing oily beads of black coffee onto the lid. A few on my hand, too, but I let them burn and turn on the air conditioning. Summer comes a little earlier every year. I back the car out past the driveway security gate we installed after it was too late, thread through the neighborhood to the feeder road, and then merge onto I-10, where concrete climbs the sky in massive on-ramps like the ribbed tails of dinosaurs. By 8 a.m., the clogged artery and triple bypassed heart of rush hour, I am pushing my way into 14 lanes of gridlock, a landscape of flashing hoods and red taillights winking feebly in the dingy morning. I need to see over the cars, so the gas-saving Prius sits in the garage while I drive Tom's hulking black Range Rover, it's not as if he's using it, down 3 different freeways to the university and back every day. Crawling along at a snail's pace, I can forget about the other commuters and focus on the chipped letters mounted on the concrete awnings of strip malls. Big Boy Dollar Store, Cartridge World, L.A. Hair. The neon pink grin of a Mexican restaurant, the yellow and blue behemoth of an IKEA rearing up behind the toll road, the jaundiced brick of apartment complexes barely shielded from the freeway by straggling rows of crepe myrtles, Everything reminds me that the worst has already happened. I need them like my mother needed her rosary. Hail, Mr. Carwash, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Pray for us, O quick, fast printing. Our Lady of Self-Storage, to thee do we send up our sighs. Even Julie's billboards are gone. There used to be one right here at the intersection of I-10 and Loop 610, by the senior living tower wedged between First Baptist and a concrete flyover, but the trustees decided the billboards should come down 5 years ago. Or has it been longer? I believe it was due to the expense, though I never had any idea how much they were costing. The Julie Fund was Tom's territory. These days, the giant, tooth-whitened smile of a megachurch pastor beams down from the billboard next to the words, "Faith every day, not everyday faith." I wonder if they papered him right over her face, or if they tore her off in strips first. Ridiculous thought. The billboards advertised a lot of things since then. Dentists, vasectomy reversals. A line of Wordsworth from today's lesson plan rattles through my head like a bad joke. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream? I flip my blinker and merge onto the loop. Despite all the time I've spent reading and studying Wordsworth's poetry, despite the fact that I am going to teach it in a few hours to a class full of impressionable young students and plan to continue teaching it, as long as my university allows me to cling to my position without publication, committee work, or any effort besides the not insubstantial difficulty I have getting out of bed every morning to face a world where the worst thing has already happened, and somehow I'm still alive, I don't believe in the glory and the dream. I believe in statistics. The statistics say that most abducted children are taken by people they know. Julie was taken by a stranger. The statistics say that most child abductors attempt to lure their victims into a vehicle. Julie was taken from her own bedroom at knife point in the middle of the night while my other daughter Jane watched from a closet. And finally, the statistics say that 3/4 of abducted children who are murdered are dead within the first 3 hours of being taken. 3 hours is just about how long we think Jane sat in her closet, rigid with fear before rousing Tom and me with panicked crying. By the time we knew Julie was gone, her fate was sealed. The inevitability of it has spread like an infection or the smell of gasoline. To make myself know that Julie is dead, I tell myself she always was. Before she was born, before I was born, before Wordsworth was born. Passing the pines of Memorial Park, I picture her staring upward with sightless eyes under a blanket of reddish-gold needles. Driving by Crestview Apartments, I see her buried in the azalea bed. The strip mall with the Sunray Nail Salon and Spa yields visions of the dumpster behind the Sunray Nail Salon and Spa. That's my visionary gleam. I used to want the world for Julie. Now I just want something to bury. My class, the last before summer break, passes in a blur. I could teach Wordsworth in my sleep, and although I'm not sleeping now, I am dreaming. I see the crystal blue of the pool, shining like a plastic gem, surrounded by a freshly sanded deck under the tall, spindly pines. The girls were so excited about the pool, and I remember asking Tom, the accountant, whether we could afford it. The Energy Corridor District, with its surplus of Starbucks and neighborhood country clubs, wasn't really our style, especially not mine. But the girls loved the pool even more than they loved having their own rooms. They didn't seem to notice that we were moving out of shabby university housing to a part of town with 2-story houses and 2-car garages and green lawns studded with signs supporting high school football teams. There are several reasons why we did that. But the one you want to hear, of course, is that we thought it would be safer. Class dismissed. Don't forget your final papers are due in my box on the 28th, no later than 5 o'clock. By the time I get to "Have a nice summer," most of them are out the door already. As I walk down the hall to my office, I feel a light burr against my hip. It's a text from Tom. "Can you pick up Jane? IAH 4:05 p.m. United 1093. I put my phone down, turn to my computer, and look up the University of Washington academic calendar. Then I check the university directory and call up a University of Washington administrator I know from grad school. A brief conversation follows. I text Tom back. Should I get dinner too? A few minutes later, nope. And that's apparently all Tom and I are going to say to each other about Jane coming home early from her freshman year of college. It's tricky picking Jane out of a crowd these days. You never know what color her hair is going to be. I stand close to baggage carousel 9 and wait until a tall girl with burgundy black hair emerges from the crowd of passengers, a lock of faded out green dangling in front of her eyes, having survived yet another dye job intact. Hi, Mom, she says. Hi, Jane. We hug, her heavy satchel thwacking my hip as she leans over, and then the empty baggage carousel utters a shuddering shriek and we both turn to look at it while I decide how best not to ask about her unexpected arrival. You changed your hair again, I observe. Yep. Everything Jane says and does is a variation on the slammed door that first became her calling card in middle school, a couple of years after Julie was taken. In high school, Jane added loud music, hair dye, and random piercings to her repertoire, but the slammed door remained the centerpiece of the performance. Tom used to follow her dutifully up the stairs, where he weathered the sobs and yells I only heard in muffled form. I figured she needed her privacy. Did you have a good flight? It was okay. It was long. I suspect Jane chose the University of Washington because of its distance from Houston. When she was a little girl, she used to say she wanted to go to the university where I teach. But the penance came down around the same time the door slamming began. She might have ended up in Alaska if she hadn't insisted on going to a school that had quarters instead of semesters. Every possible difference, a crucial one. All typical teenage behavior, no doubt, but with Jane, it made a particular kind of perverse sense, as does the fact that, according to the registrar, she took incompletes in all her spring quarter classes. This after she'd stayed in Seattle through the entire school year. I didn't think much about her not coming home for Thanksgiving. It's commonly skipped by students on the quarter system since the fall quarter starts so late. But when she explained to us over the phone in mid-December that she was just settling in, that one of her professors had invited her to a holiday dinner, that our family never really celebrated Christmas anyway, did we, and that she felt like it would be good for her sense of independence to stay, I could practically hear Tom's heart breaking over the extension. I covered for his silence by saying the sensible thing, the only possible thing, really. We'll miss you, of course, but we understand. Now it seems the whole holiday situation was yet another slammed door to which I'd failed to respond properly. So, I say, starting again. You still enjoying UW? Go, Huskies, she says with a limp fist pump. Yeah, Mom, nothing's really changed since last time we talked. The bags start dropping onto the conveyor belt and we both lean forward. Was that coat warm enough for January up there? Winter stuff is on clearance. We could go shopping. She picks self-consciously at the army jacket she's worn since she was 16. This is fine. I told you guys, it doesn't get that cold. Class is going okay? Yeah, she says. Why? Just making small talk. Well, they're going really well, she says. Actually, they're going so well my professors are letting me turn in papers in lieu of exams. In lieu of exams? That sounds official. I wonder how she got them to agree to give her incompletes rather than failing her. My students usually just say family emergency and hope I don't press them for details. Carefully, I ask, is that something they do a lot at UW? Mom, she says, just say University of Washington. I give her shoulder a quick squeeze. We're just glad you're home. I lower my arm and we stand there, side by side, staring at the shiny metal chute, until half the passengers on the flight have claimed their bags and wheeled them off, their absence making the juddering of the conveyor belt sound even louder. Finally, Jane's rolling suitcase somersaults down the chute and thunks onto the belt in front of us. It was a graduation present, apple green and already dingy from its maiden voyage to Seattle and back. It almost matches her dyed green streak. She grabs the suitcase before I can make a move, but lets me take her satchel when she stops to peel off her army jacket in the blast of humid air that hits us outside the automatic sliding doors. I see we're in swamp mode already. No place like home, I reply, and am rewarded with a half-smile of acknowledgement. The ride home is rocky, though. I'm shooting blanks on college life despite spending most of my time in a university. How are the dorms? Pretty good. You still like your roommate? She's fine. We stay out of each other's way. Are you going to room with her next year? Probably not. Finally, I resort to a subject I'm sure will get results, although it pains me. So, tell me about this English professor you ate Christmas dinner with. Her name is Caitlin, and actually she's a professor of semiotics. Caitlin. I didn't know they still taught semiotics in English departments. The course is called Intersectionalities. It's an English class, but it's cross-listed with linguistics, gender studies, and anthro. There are supposed to be all these prerequisites, but I went to Caitlin's office hours on the first day and convinced her to let me in. I can't help but feel a glow of pride. A true professor's kid, Jane knows all the angles. Moreover, this is the longest string of consecutive words she's spoken to me without Tom around for ages. Tell me more about it. What did you read? I think I'd rather wait and talk about it with Dad, too, she says. Of course, I say. I don't want to say it all twice. Sure, sweetie. I turn on NPR, and the measured, comforting sound of rush hour news commentary fills the car as we inch past a firing range and a gym, where an Olympian gymnastics coach is probably even now yelling at ponytailed girls in formation. Jane stares out her window. I assume she is wondering why Tom didn't come to pick her up instead of me. I'm wondering, too. A few minutes later, we both find out. Pulling into the driveway, the sky just starting to glow with dusk, I spot Tom through the kitchen window making dinner. As I open the door and walk in, I smell Jane's favorite pasta dish. Fettuccine Alfredo tossed with breaded shrimp and grilled asparagus, a ridiculously decadent recipe Tom got off the Food Network and makes only on special occasions. An expiatory salad of fresh greens is in a bowl next to the cutting board, ready to join the bright fiesta ware on the dining room table. Janie! Tom opens his arms and steps forward, and Jane throws her arms around him, squeezing her eyes shut against his chest. I slip off to the bathroom, then to the bedroom to change out of my teaching outfit into more comfortable jeans, loitering for a few minutes to put away some laundry that's been sitting folded in a basket at the foot of the bed. When I return, they are talking animatedly. Tom's back to me as he chops heirloom tomatoes for the salad, Jane resting the tips of her fingers on the butcher block as if playing a piano. "Dad, you would not believe the names people were throwing around in this class," she says. Derrida, stuff like that. Everyone was so much smarter than me.
Hey, she let you in, and she's the MacArthur genius lady.
Every time I open my mouth, I sounded like an idiot.
At least you opened your mouth,
he says, resting the knife to the side of the cutting board for a moment while he looks her in the eye.
I bet there were some people who were too scared to talk.
Jane's grateful smile, just visible over Tom's shoulder, curdles me like milk. As if he can sense it, Tom turns around and sees me standing there. He throws a handful of chopped tomatoes onto the pile of greens and picks up the salad bowl.
"Everything's ready," he says. "Grab the pasta, Jane. Let's sit down and eat our first family dinner in God knows how long."
And that, believe it or not, is when the doorbell rings. 2. The first thing I see is her pale hair, all lit up in the rosy, polluted glow of the Houston sunset. Then her face. Ashen skin stretched thin over wide cheekbones, flushed red across the top so that the dark circles stand out under her sunken eyes. The face looks both young and old. She wears worn-out jeans with holes at the knees, a t-shirt. She opens her mouth to speak, and I see that her feet are bare. There's something familiar about her, but it's like my entire body has become fused with my surroundings, my brain rewired to resemble blind hands fumbling, the sensory data bumping uselessly around in search of something to latch onto. Hair, eyes, young, bare. Her eyes widen and the color drains from her face. My hands stretch out in front of me, palms out, fingers spread wide, ready to shield me from the nuclear sunset, or as if I'm about to fall down. But it's the girl on the porch who falls, her knees buckling so that she folds up neatly as she collapses onto the mat, blonde hair catching lightly in the azalea bushes on her way down. I open my mouth and I think I must be yelling for Tom, although I can't hear it because my brain is still blinded by the sunset glancing off her face. He comes running up behind me, stops, and then thunders through the doorway. When I look again, the girl has all but vanished into his arms, the loops and tangles of her hair crushed between his fingers as he hugs her to his chest, rocking back and forth. "Julie, Julie, Julie," he is sobbing like the chorus of the nightmares that I now know have never stopped but have been unreeling every night for 8 years, and perhaps all day long as well in a continuous stream I have simply chosen to deny. The sight of Jane standing stock still in the hallway flips the light switch back on in my head. "Call 911, I manage to say. "Tell them we need an ambulance." To Tom, who is making strange animal sounds of grief I have also heard in my dreams, I say, "Bring her in." And just like that, the worst unhappens. Julie is home. The first 24 hours after Julie's reappearance are oddly similar to the first 24 hours after her disappearance, a mirror symmetry that lends extra significance to every detail. There's the humidity of the long, hot summer's beginning, the crepe myrtles that were already dropping their flowers when she was taken in early fall, just now starting to put out blossoms like crumpled scraps of tissue paper. There are the sirens blaring their way through the neighborhood up to our house just like last time, but bringing EMS rather than the police, and at sunset rather than sunrise. So the neighbors who open their front doors to see what's happening are wearing work clothes rather than bathrobes, holding oven mitts rather than newspapers. Everything is backward, like a photo negative of tragedy. Only one of us can ride in the ambulance with Julie, and Tom immediately steps forward, so Jane and I climb into the SUV and follow behind. When we pull up to the ED, they are unloading her gurney, now connected to a rolling IV, and she is wheeled inside and installed in a curtained-off room with that excruciating combination of slowness and urgency native to emergency departments. The next 30 minutes pass like hours under the fluorescent lights. Julie wakes, mumbles, sleeps again. Tom sits by the bedside, holding Julie's hand and murmuring something unintelligible. I pace. Jane leans. Nurses come in at odd intervals, never telling us anything, but instead asking for details about insurance or Julie's medical history. Questions that seem so useless and redundant that I become convinced that some of these people just want to see the famous Whittaker girl in the flesh. One nurse comes in to draw blood, and Julie starts awake at the cold, wet cotton swab on her inner forearm, keeps her eyes open just long enough to nod vaguely at the nurse's bright questions, then fades as soon as the needle is in. The curtain that separates us from the hall flutters as people rush by and does nothing to block out the cacophony of squeaking wheels, indecipherable PA announcements and hallway conferences punctuated with loud sighs and occasional laughter. When the doctor finally comes, she sends everyone out of the room over Tom's and my objections.
"I just need her for 2 seconds," she says. "You, Mom, Dad, don't go anywhere."
Needless to say, we don't. But Jane takes the opportunity to find a restroom. The doctor emerges from the curtained room after a hushed conversation I strain unsuccessfully to hear, and I glimpse Julie in the background, awake but flushed and disoriented, before she pulls the curtain shut behind her. Julie is dehydrated, the doctor tells us, suffering from exhaustion and exposure, and hasn't eaten for a few days. but there don't seem to be any injuries or illnesses, no substances in her bloodstream.
After the fluids take effect, most likely she'll be right as rain, she finishes.
Her use of the expression right as rain, proving she cannot possibly have read the chart, or she has never watched the news, or she is so calloused by her job that she lacks the power to think past a stock phrase indelibly associated in her mind with the word fluids.
Just get her to the clinic for a follow-up after a few weeks. They'll schedule her when she's discharged.
As we file back into Julie's room, there's a knock on the wall, and a police detective steps in after us. 40-ish, with dark hair, looking not unlike a police detective from a TV show, but far less attractive. He leaves the curtain open a foot and stares at Julie from the improvised doorway.
Julie Whittaker, he says. Unbelievable.
Julie doesn't take any notice of him, but on seeing Tom and me again, she collapses back onto the pillow, crying tearlessly. Tom rushes to enfold her in his arms. Noting my expression, the doctor says they'll move Julie to a room with a door as soon as one opens up, and then she hustles out. The cop introduces himself as Detective Overby and starts asking me questions about the circumstances of Julie's arrival, which I answer as best I can, considering that, for all I know, she could have come straight out of the glowing orange sunset, or a god's forehead, or the side of a man opened up while he was sleeping. The question of how she was delivered to us seems that unimportant. In the background, I hear Tom repeating the words,
"You're safe now. It's okay. The doctor says you're going to be okay."
He is talking to himself as much as to her, and though the words aren't meant for me, they're so comforting that I let my attention drift toward them and away from Detective Overby's questions. He notices.
"I'd like to talk to Julie alone for just a few minutes."
"No," Julie says, clutching Tom's arm but looking at me. "Don't go."
"This won't take long."
Tom stands directly in front of Julie's bed. He's a tall, broad man, imposing even with a gut.
"Absolutely not. We left her alone once tonight for the doctor. We're not leaving her again."
Tom and the detective begin to argue back and forth, and the tiny curtained room shrinks. The same words keep coming up, and at first I think Detective Overby is questioning our mental health or Julie's. He is talking about the sane, the safe. Finally, he addresses Julie directly, speaking right through Tom.
"I know you're not feeling well, ma'am, and I hate to bother you right now," he says, "but I need to ask, were you sexually assaulted?"
Julie just looks at the detective and nods. Tom sets his jaw, and I find a moment to be glad Jane is still not back from the restroom. Detective Overby explains about the forensic exam, and I realize SANE and SAFE are acronyms.
"The sexual assault nurse examiner has already been dispatched," he says. "She should be here soon to set up the exam room. The minute you're off the IV, she can get started."
Julie shakes her head no, and Tom steps forward, looking ready for a fistfight. Detective Overby, equally imposing, stands his ground.
"If there's any evidence of sexual assault, it's best to collect it."
"Listen,"
Tom says, pointing his finger at the detective for emphasis.
"We've done everything the police told us to since day one and never asked a single question we weren't supposed to. 8 years later, after we've..."
He chokes.
"Years since we've heard any news, and our missing daughter shows up on our doorstep, no thanks to you, and now you want to keep her up all night asking her questions, treating her like a crime scene?"
He snorts.
"We'll come in tomorrow."
Detective Overby starts to answer, but a faint noise from Julie's bed stops him.
"The last time was a long time ago," she says quietly. "At least 6 months."
Detective Overby sighs, as if the news that our daughter hasn't been raped in 6 months is disappointing but acceptable.
"Okay, then. We still recommend you come back for the exam, but from a forensic perspective, there's no rush. Rest up, and we'll get a full statement from you folks at the station tomorrow."
Julie nods weakly. Tom slumps forward, hands on knees. Jane comes in, a juice box in her hand. She must have gotten it from the nurse's station. When she sees Julie awake, she smiles shyly and says, "Welcome back." 6 hours later, in the middle of the night, Julie is discharged, fully hydrated and wearing hospital scrubs to replace the scruffy t-shirt and jeans the police took for evidence. She leans on Tom's arm while I sweep everything into my purse. Prophylactic antibiotics for chlamydia and gonorrhea, a prescription for Valium in case she has trouble sleeping, and a folder stuffed to bursting with pamphlets on sexual assault and Xeroxed phone list for HPD victim services and various women's shelters. It also holds Detective Overby's card, tucked into four slits in the front of the folder so it won't get lost. I remove it and slip it into the back pocket of my jeans. Tom drives us home, Julie sleeping in the back seat of the SUV on the disposable pillow they let her keep. Jane, who slept quite a bit in the hospital, now stares at Julie silently. Nobody talks, in part because we don't want to wake Julie, but also because we ourselves do not want to wake up. Or maybe that's just me. It's 3 a.m. when we open the back door and walk into the kitchen through the laundry room. It looks like some other family's house preserved on a perfectly normal day, a museum of ordinariness. Over the washing machine, a blouse drips dry. On the cutting board, a heap of glistening red chopped tomatoes lies next to a knife and a puddle of red juice. Through the doorway to the dining room, Jane's elaborate homecoming meal sits forgotten on the dining room table. The salad wilted, the breading on the fried shrimp gone soggy, the sauce gelled on the cold, gummy pasta. As the others pass through the kitchen into the living room, I head into the dining room and start picking up the dishes full of pasta. It takes only a moment for me to stack the evidence that we were surviving in the kitchen sink. When I join them in the living room, Jane and Tom are standing awkwardly by the sofa with Julie, like people putting up a distant relative for the night. Tom is shaking his head, red-faced, and when I realize what they are discussing, my efforts in the dining room seem futile. Tom moved his office into Julie's room 7 years ago. He did not discuss it with me first, nor did he let me know he was quitting his accounting job, the job we moved to the Energy Corridor for in the first place, to go into private practice as a tax consultant. One day I passed her room and saw it had been transformed from bedroom to carefully tended shrine. A desk and file cabinet where her bed used to be. Posters replaced with framed pictures of Julie. I understood without being told that this new office was to be his command center for the search, that he was turning his longing for her into a full-time job. Only now, with Julie standing in front of us, does it look like an exorcism. "I don't mind the sofa," Julie is saying. "She can have my room," Jane says, still hanging back like she's afraid to stand too close. Clutching her elbow awkwardly, she looks more like her 10-year-old self than I would have thought possible, though I notice with a pang that she's taller than Julie by quite a few inches. Jane stares at Julie, not hungrily like Tom, who looks as if he'll never let her out of his sight again, but with a wary expression. "I don't mind." "No, please," Julie says. "I don't want to take anyone's room." I have a sudden longing to bed her down between Tom and me, like we did when she was a 7-year-old with a fever and couldn't stop shivering. This, however, is not practical. And meanwhile, the living room yawns open like a mouth around us, the windows dark behind the curtains. "Tom, the air mattress?" I offer. "She could be in her room until we can move your desk out." "A door that closes would be nice," she says, and it's decided. She has no toiletries or luggage, and no one wants to ask why, so Jane gives her a t-shirt and shorts to sleep in, and I scrounge up a spare toothbrush still in its package. After the bustle is over, Julie disappears behind the door of Tom's office, like the sun behind a cloud. I wonder if she is comforted or disturbed by all the pictures of her in there. By the time we have seen Jane to bed as well, with reassurances that she can decide if she wants to come to the station when she wakes up, it's almost dawn. The bedroom door closes and my legs want to buckle under me, but I also feel more awake than I have for years. My mind is racing, or rather somersaulting, tumbling over itself as I go through my bathroom routine. Tom says, "Anna," in a way that suggests it is the second or third time. I come out of the bathroom and see him lying on his side of the bed, looking up expectantly. Instead of finding out what he wants, I surprise myself by saying exactly what I'm thinking. "What are we going to do?"
"She's back," he says. "We don't have to do anything anymore."
I slide out of my jeans, keeping my t-shirt on to sleep in.
"She's back,"
he repeats like a stubborn child. We don't know what she's been through. I think of the detective's card tucked into the pocket of my jeans as I hang them on the back of the closet door.
"We have to be careful." "We should have been more careful then."
His voice breaks a little. I emerge from the closet. "She may not be the same."
"None of us are,"
Tom says. There's a long pause.
"You didn't believe she would ever come home."
I sit down on the edge of the bed. I can feel his eyes burrowing into the back of my head, and I close my own, tasting the accusation. After a moment, I turn to face him. "I didn't believe we would find her," I say, trusting him to know the difference. He doesn't answer, but as I lean over to turn off the light on my nightstand, I feel something shift. Just a little piece of the night air between us moving aside, like a breeze wafting through a chink in a wall. He turns onto his side, facing away from me, but there's something about this argument that reminds me of the marriage we used to have, the arguments that bubbled up only when we were in bed together. How gamely we entered every fight back then, knowing we'd still wake up next to each other in the morning. Now, staring at Tom's back, I think, Julie is home. Anything can happen. I see her face again the way I saw it on the front porch, just barely familiar. The flesh melted away from her cheekbones and jaw, leaving a butterfly of bone. "Good night," I say. I sleep until noon and wake to the noise of pans clattering downstairs, voices in the kitchen. I know this dream. It's the one where Julie shows up and I say, "I've dreamed about you so many times, but this time you're really home." Now I get up and splash water on my face in the bathroom and look at myself in the mirror, waiting for the features to distort, to drift. Everything stays put. This one is real. A chill runs through me, and a faint headache alights in my frontal lobe. I pull on my jeans from last night and head downstairs. The kitchen table is bathed in light. My radiantly blonde daughter sits on the side nearest the window, still wearing Jane's t-shirt, which is too big on her. Tom beams at her from the head of the table as they talk. About nothing, it seems. Orange juice, the weather. Does anybody want more eggs? For a moment, it looks almost normal. Then Jane comes in with a glass in her hand and sits across from Julie, and a shiver walks down my spine as I observe the odd regularity that has returned to our family. A girl for each side of the table. Four sides for four people. The words "fearful symmetry" pop into my head. "Good morning," I say from the doorway. "You slept forever," Jane says. But Julie is already getting up, and in three long strides she has embraced me. It takes me aback. How long has it been since a daughter of mine came rushing into my arms from across the room? Just as I am starting to notice the scent of her hair, she pulls back and looks at me, her hands sliding down my arms to grasp my hands. "Hi, Mom," she says, a little awkwardly. And for a moment we are looking straight into each other's eyes. I have become accustomed to looking at Jane, who shares my distinctive features. My sharp nose and deep-set eyes. As I stare into Julie's woman's face, I realize there are no moles, no bumps or blemishes or wrinkles. She's perfect. She breaks away, embarrassed, and I realize I have been staring.
"I'm sorry," I say. "I haven't seen your face in so long."
"I know," Tom says. "Sit down. I'm just getting some coffee," I say. Did you sleep okay? There's a big pan on the stove with some scrambled eggs left in it, and I put some on a plate, suddenly ravenous. I slept very well, she says, like a polite guest. The air mattress was comfortable.
She's only been up for a few minutes, Tom says. I've been fielding phone calls from the police department all morning. Come in whenever you want apparently means if you're not here by 9, you'll be hearing from us.
His face darkens.
I suppose it makes sense. They're worried about the press. I'm sure that'll be starting any time now.
Julie's smile fades. I guess we should probably go now that Mom's awake. Tom puts a hand over hers on the table.
You take as much time as you need.
The sooner we go, the sooner it'll be over, I say. Tom's eyes tear up, and I realize he doesn't want to know what she went through. At the same time, it occurs to me that I do. Julie is studying my face with an almost grateful expression. Yes, she says. I want to get it over with. I can tell by the way she's looking at me that Julie needs me there, and no one else. I can't keep Tom away from the police station, but I decide I'm going to persuade him to stay out in the hall, which means Jane will have to come too to give him someone to look after. Come on, Julie, I say. I'll find you something in my closet to wear. A skirt, I think, looking at her dwindled frame, and I'll need some safety pins.
He said he would kill me if I struggled, kill my family.
You believed him? Says Overby.
We are sitting in the police station. Me, Julie, Overby, and a younger female detective, Detective Harris, in a private room with frosted glass windows and a single table. Tom is outside waiting in the lobby with Jane, per Julie's request. Overby wanted to question Julie alone, but she looked from his face to my face and then back, and he sighed and invited me in. I'm holding, but not drinking, a cup of black coffee so weak you can see air bubbles clinging to the inside of the styrofoam. Read the imprint of the serial number on the bottom. It was brought to me by Detective Harris. Typical, I think. While Overby asked the questions.
Of course I believed him, Julie says now. He had a knife at my throat.
A kitchen knife. Overby says, consulting his notes as if he doesn't already know everything in the case file. Taken from the household. Any other weapons? She was 13, I break in. But Overby holds up his hand and nods for Julie to go on, and it's true she doesn't seem upset.
Not that I saw, but I believed him. And if it was happening to me again now, knowing what I know about him, I would still believe him.
She takes a breath. Once we were out of the house, we got on a bus just by the CVS there on Memorial Drive and went to the bus station downtown.
Did anyone see you?
The bus driver, maybe, but I was too scared to say anything. At the bus station, he bought 2 tickets. We got off in El Paso.
She pauses and her eyes go dead.
That's where he raped me for the first time.
Do you remember where you were?
Some motel, I don't remember which one.
Motel 6, Econo Lodge.
She glares at him icily. Sorry. We stayed there for only a couple days, and then we were gone again. We moved all the time. He stole a car in El Paso. Overby makes a subtle gesture without looking at Harris, who writes something down. And for a while we drove that, but he sold it somehow, I guess. He just came back without it one day.
He left you alone?
Yes, he left me tied up and gagged when he had to go out. We were in Mexico when he sold the car, I think, but I'm not sure because I was blindfolded, and then I was in the back of a van for a long time. The duct tape in a van dream floats before my eyes. It took me a while to find out he'd sold me.
He what?
Overby looks up sharply. He sold me, she says. 5 men, maybe 6. Harris nods and returns to writing.
Did those men?
Oh, yes. She gives a cold, brittle smile. Yes, they did. My eyes close. Mrs. Whittaker, are you all right? It's Harris's voice. I am sinking. eyes shut into a cold black vapor that prickles at my extremities. I hear Overby correct his partner. Mrs. Davalos goes by her maiden name, and snap my eyes back open, but the black dots take a moment to clear. I'm fine, I whisper. I want to reach for Julie's hand, but her arms are folded tightly across her chest. Could you identify any of the men? I was blindfolded, she repeats patiently. Any accents? She thinks. Some of them spoke Spanish to each other, but none of them talked very much. Anyway, that was a couple of days, I think. I can't remember it very well. Then they sold me again to someone important this time. The detectives look meaningfully at each other. Who? I never knew his name. The other men called him El Jefe when they were talking about him, Señor to his face. Go on, Overby says calmly, while Harris scribbles furiously. How did you know he was important? He had a giant house, like a compound, with bodyguards and a household staff and a lot of men with big guns coming to him for orders. She stops and takes a breath. Please don't ask me where. I don't know. I didn't go outside.
For how long?
For 8 years.
Later, I tell Tom as little as I can get away with. Enough to explain the pages of thumbnail photos Julie looked through at the station, pictures of Mexican men in their 50s with high foreheads and thick chins. I narrate the various stages of her captivity, but not the cigarette burns she got when she tried to escape, the years of rape, but not the way she spoke of them, as if describing the plot of a not particularly interesting television show. I tell him that her captor tired of her, but not that she was too old for him once out of her teens. I tell him that she was blindfolded and taken in a helicopter to a rooftop in Juarez, but not that the guard was most likely supposed to kill her rather than let her go. I tell him that she hid in the back of a truck to get across the border, but not that she was afraid of the U.S. Border Patrol because she wasn't sure she could still speak English or anything at all after so long. That she jumped out of the truck at a stoplight and ran, but not that she dragged herself, foot after foot, along the I-10 feeder road for miles, invisible from the freeway, like the people you learn not to see stumbling through gas station parking lots, clutching their possessions in plastic bags.
My God, he says under his breath.
We are at the kitchen table and the girls are upstairs in bed, a peculiar throwback to the quiet discussions we used to have long ago about topics so trivial I can't imagine why we bothered hiding them.
So she was sold to a human trafficking ring, then to some drug lord?
It's strange how hearing him say those phrases out loud makes it into a story, more than the jumbled words in the interview room did. That's what it sounds like, yes. Tom is leaning forward on his elbows on the kitchen table, holding on to himself, every muscle tensed.
Well, is that what the detectives say?
They didn't say much at all, really. They were just taking her statement, asking questions.
Right. They don't want to say anything that might upset us, like, you know, human trafficking or forced prostitution. That might imply they know about it and can't do anything to stop it.
Tom's voice breaks on this last exclamation. He's not bothering to lower his voice anymore. I think they may know something. Harris mentioned a task force.
Yes, there's a statewide task force on human trafficking.
Tom surprises me by saying, I am reminded of how much work he has done, how many search organizations he's joined, the support group for parents of missing children, the Facebook pages, and wonder what else he knows that I don't.
They formed it a couple of years ago after a big report came out. Obviously, it came too late to help Julie, but I guess we should be thrilled that she can help them.
He sighs heavily.
How was she in there?
She seemed fine. I say, all things considered. One of the detectives told me she's in shock and needs to see a therapist.
Of course, Tom says. I'll find someone. I'll call tonight.
3. To get through the first week, I take her shopping. What else am I going to do with this 21-year-old woman who has shown up to replace my missing 13-year-old daughter? Besides, she doesn't have any clothes. The first few days, I lend her things of mine to wear. She's closer to my size than Jane's. But it gives me the strangest feeling to see her draped in one of my severe black tunics, her blonde hair swallowed up in its oversized cowl like a paper doll dressed for a funeral. I have some errands to run at Target, I lie. Want to come? We can get you some clothes. Julie used to love back-to-school shopping with me, especially picking out all the notebooks and pens and pencils in purple and pink and glittery green. On top of buying her the usual jeans and t-shirts and underwear, I always got her one completely new first day of school outfit, and she would keep it hanging on her doorknob for weeks, counting down the days. I still go to the same Target, which has, of course, barely changed at all in 8 years. And I wonder whether the memories it brings back of one of our few mother-daughter activities are as pleasant to her as they are to me. But once we're there, the red walls seem too aggressive somehow. The fluorescent lights glaring on the white linoleum walkways, headache-inducing. Julie follows me obediently around the store as if it's her first time in there, or indeed in any store, and I can't help but wince at the racks of neon bikinis all tangled up on their hangers, the viscose mini-dresses lying on the floor under the sale rack, the red and white bullseye logo suspended over bins of brightly colored underwear. If the clothes in my closet seem too dour for a 21-year-old, everything here seems too flimsy and disposable for someone with a face like Julie's. Hurrying us past the clothing department, I grab a cheese grater at random from the kitchen section and we stand, a little absurdly, in the express lane, waiting to check out. Julie stares fixedly at the rows of candy bars in their bright boxes, and I'm struck by how much this is like standing at the baggage carousel with Jane, the silence of two people trying to pretend it's ordinary how little they're talking. Except with Jane, I know she doesn't want to talk. Not to me, anyway. With Julie, who knows? But whatever conversation I am waiting to have with her, we are not going to have it in the express lane of Target. Not even with the extra 2 minutes gained from the woman in front of us arguing over a sale price. I've heard the story, but who really knows what she's been through or how she feels about it? Look at her now, I think, staring at nothing. But she's not. Once we get through the line and out into the car, she says, I used to love that movie. What movie? A Little Princess? Now I recall seeing it on the display stand near the register. I don't remember much about the movie aside from its exceptionally lurid color palette. It's one of those boarding school stories, I know, where they're mean to the orphan girl. They keep her up in the attic. I feel a hint of panic. You should have said something. We could have bought it. It's okay, I don't want it. We can go back. Mom, I was just remembering. But I'm almost crying in the silence that follows. She turns her head toward the window and says, The Indian gentleman searches everywhere for her so he can pass on her father's fortune, but it turns out she's been next door to him the whole time. I try to speak, but nothing comes out. I used to think about that sometimes. She says shortly, by way of explanation, turning her head back to me. The veil of kindness has dropped back over her eyes. Outside it starts to rain. We speed toward Nordstrom, where I buy her heaping armfuls of silk tank tops, designer jeans, cashmere sweaters on ultra sale, collared shirts and peasant blouses and plain, tissue-thin t-shirts at $50 a pop. I buy her a purse, a wallet, a belt, a pair of brown calfskin loafers and some white sandals, and 3 pairs of flats in different colors, all designer, but with the logo print fabric tucked away on the inside, so you can't tell how expensive they are. I'll know, though. Julie will know, too, although I do my best to keep the price tags away from her after I catch her checking the tag on a blouse and then trying unobtrusively to hang it back on the rack. Julie, I say firmly. She nods with a small smile, and I feel a rush of elation, strong, like the first sip of coffee after a good night's rest. For the next 2 hours, I stand outside the dressing room and hand her sizes and shades and styles of everything. Bras, blazers, even swimsuits. While I am